Daniel Lazar, author and journalist. Brian Terrell, thank you so much, political commentator and peace activist. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Ikova Tahwe and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما في الأرض من ذا الذي عنده إلا بإذنه لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماء من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه يعلم ما بين أيديهم وما ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء وسع
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens, and whatever is in the earth, is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him, but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran submits its response to U.S. amendments to an EU proposal for the revival of the JCPOA, saying its text has a constructive approach aimed at finalizing the talks. A Palestinian rights group says Israel has killed 112 people in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip since the beginning of this year. And a U.S. military report says sexual assault among women has reached tragic and devastating levels, with a year-on-year increase of roughly 13% in 2021. Thank you for joining us. The top story this hour. Iran says it has put forth its views on the U.S. response to an EU proposal on reviving the 2015 deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says an expert team carefully reviewed the U.S. response and submitted its views to the EU coordinator. Kanani says the text Iran sent has a constructive approach aimed at finalizing the JCPOA revival negotiations. Washington has confirmed that it has received Iran's response, but says it was not constructive. The U.S. says it will convey its views to the EU. The JCPOA was thrown into chaos in 2018 when the U.S. pulled out of it and imposed anti-Iran sanctions. Tehran says it's serious to reach a durable and strong revival agreement. Researcher and political analyst Christopher Halali tells us about his views on the possibility of the JCPOA revival deal.
We are close, but I remain cautiously, optimistic at this point. What reports we are getting out from various leaks, both in the press on both sides, include that we are close to a deal, that something is close. I'm very concerned, of course, what Israel is doing behind the scenes, what some of the other countries that are antagonistic to Iran are doing behind the scenes, and also within Washington, establishment and the politicians who are much more hawkish on Iran. I believe that they're going to do everything they can now to derail a possible, resumption of a deal with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Ultimately, Biden is in an election year, and so I think that he's trying to push for a deal, but he's politically unstable, and his ability to get reelected or for his party to get, to maintain control of the House and Senate isn't secure. So I remain cautious about this news that's coming out that a deal is imminent. Mm-hmm. And it's my hope that it happens. But of course, I also know that Iran has red lines and it doesn't want to be crossed. And hopefully the Americans can come to their senses.
A Palestinian rights group says the Israeli regime has killed 112 people in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip since the beginning of 2022. According to a report by the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, over 1,200 civilians were also injured during Israel's repeated attacks against Palestinians. That includes nearly 200 children and 40 women. According to the report, 32 civilians, including 8 children, were killed during a recent aggression on Gaza in August alone. The report also adds that Palestinians have been subjected to hundreds of repeated Israeli crimes, such as raids on buildings and holy sites, as well as storming and demolition of homes. The center has labeled Israeli operations as war crimes, saying they violated all international laws and conventions. The U.S. military experienced its highest recorded level of sexual assault among women last year. That's according to new findings published by the Pentagon. The survey shows sexual assault saw an increase of roughly 13% in 2021 compared to the previous year. The figures also indicate that more than 8% of active duty women are estimated to have experienced some form of unwanted sexual contact. The Pentagon describes the findings as, quote, tragic, disappointing, and devastating. The data show a large portion of women in the U.S. military do not trust the system to treat them with dignity, respect, and ensure their safety after an incident. U.S. veteran Seth Manzel says military commanders used to be the ones investigating sexual assault cases, and that caused many reports to be ignored. Have a listen.
There's a lot of things going down in the ranks, and I think that the Biden administration's new approach is better, having civilians doing the investigations. Prior to that, commanders would have to do these investigations, and no one wanted that on their officer the report on their personnel reports. They thought that it made the unit look bad to report things like that, and so a lot of it was swept under the rug. And I think what we're seeing is just a lot of it coming out more now because people are more comfortable with reporting under the newer system. It is still tragically high, and but hopefully they can do more to address it, because it's still underreported. A lot of it still gets swept under the rug.
U.S. President Joe Biden has accused supporters of his predecessor Donald Trump of seeking to take the country backwards, warning that democracy there is not guaranteed. Biden said Trump and his Republican supporters represent an extremism that threatens the very foundations of the country's republic. The president also lashed out at those Republicans for backing Trump's so-called Make America Great Again ideology. He accused them of seeking to ignore the Constitution. Biden slammed the 2021 deadly attack on Congress by Trump supporters too. He said there is no place for political violence in America. The president urged the Americans to defend and stand up for democracy in their country. His Thursday speech comes just 2 months ahead of midterm congressional elections. Argentina's vice president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, escaped assassination as she was greeting her supporters outside her home in Buenos Aires. A man emerged from the crowd, pointing a handgun in Fernandez's face, but the gun failed to fire when triggered. The shooter is now in custody. He is said to be a Brazilian. His motive is still unclear. Argentina's president, Alberto Fernandez, called the shooting the most serious incident since the country returned to democracy in 1983. He also declared Friday a national holiday to give people time to express themselves in solidarity with the vice president. Venezuela has slammed the attempted shooting as well. Fernandez de Kirchner, or de Kirchner, is in the midst of a corruption trial. She denies the charges. As South Korea and the U.S. wrapped up their joint military exercises, civic leaders in Seoul called for the suspension of such military drills and an end to cooperation with Japan. Meanwhile, South Korea's Ministry of National Defense suggested North Korea was responsible for the current tension on the Korean Peninsula due to its nuclear weapons, despite new South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's references to U.S. extended deterrence. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
Civil society leaders gathered outside the American embassy in Seoul to demand the permanent suspension of U.S. South Korea military exercises. The drills are scheduled to wrap up Thursday, although routine training takes place year-round.
Unadvertised training can be more dangerous as it prepares for war. We demand that such regular military exercises, which take place on the Korean Peninsula all year, and the joint South Korea-U.S. military exercise itself be permanently suspended.
This year's large-scale joint drills were conducted for the first time in more than 4 years.
In addition to South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's efforts to strengthen the military and alliance with the United States, Seoul is looking to bolster ties with Japan. President Yoon's foreign policy advisor this week meets with his U.S. and Japanese counterparts in Hawaii to coordinate deterrence against North Korea and discuss other so-called trilateral alliance issues.
Many South Koreans resent President Yoon's Japan policy.
President Yoon Suk-yeol does not think about the people and does not think about the national interest. He is cooperating with Japan and the United States to push the people into war.
South Korean officials blame North Korea for raising tension.
Nuclear states and countries considered as nuclear states in the world have repeatedly stressed they won't use their nuclear weapons. But North Korea is hinting at using them for the strategic purpose of pressuring South Korea and the international community.
The Yoon administration frequently refers to U.S. extended deterrence of U.S. nuclear weapons in South Korea's defense. South Korea hosts 28,500 U.S. troops at bases across the country. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A new book in UK media reports disclosed Britain's policy or police and security services helped cover up the role of the Canadian intelligence agency in a British teenager's journey to join Daesh terror group in 2015. Our correspondent Robert Carter reports.
Did the UK authorities cover up the trafficking of three British schoolgirls who joined the notorious Daesh terror group back in 2015? That is the question now being asked following shock allegations revealed in a new book, which claims that Canadian intelligence officers informed British police that the girls had entered Syria with the help of a double agent, Mohammed al-Rashid, who provided information to Canada on who he had smuggled to ISIL. One of the girls involved is the former UK citizen Shamima Begum, who is currently fighting for a return to Britain under the argument she was groomed by traffickers.
An inquiry has been demanded after it emerged that Canada knew about the teenager's fate but kept silent while the Metropolitan Police ran a frantic international search for the trio. The book has claimed that Canada privately admitted its involvement only when it feared being exposed and successfully asked British authorities to cover up its role. The scandal has now reopened the debate over stripping Begum of her nationality.
Now, the reason that was rather egregious for us was because we had asked specifically the Met Police at the end of March 2015 about updates regarding anything that could be coming of use from al-Rashid, and they confirmed that they had no updates. And that clearly is not the case if what Richard Walton is saying is actually true in this book. This revelation about a Canadian security services asset being one fundamental element that allowed these girls to cross over, well, that speaks against error. It speaks more to a concerted, securitized effort to have these girls go across. And that's actually true of the Canadians. The question remains of whether other security agencies who were working with these girls, with these handlers of this Canadian asset, who wanted the same thing. And that's a question, and that's why an inquiry is very important.
A spokesman for the UK government said they do not comment on operational intelligence or security matters. But choosing to remain silent won't be enough to quell the growing questions surrounding the way Western intelligence dealt with Daesh or their sophisticated smuggling operations, which saw so many Westerners slip through the net, including the young and vulnerable. Robert Carter, London.
As Italy is crippled with soaring energy costs, its government is discussing the adoption of energy-saving measures for the winter. Some members of the EU have already introduced similar measures in an attempt to reduce gas usage. Max Civili reports from Rome.
On Thursday, Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a council of ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine.
Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, 3 times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that the price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement has warned the Saudi-led coalition that it would fail in its attempt to occupy the country and dominate the Yemeni nation. Abdulmalik al-Houthi was speaking on the occasion of a military parade held in the port city of Hodeidah. He hailed the country's forces, saying they have proved their capabilities by turning the plots of the enemies to occupy Yemen into an illusion, a nightmare. Al-Houthi said the Yemeni nation will continue to defend its freedom and independence. The Ansarullah leader underlined that aggressors could not move the nation away from its fundamental positions, including on the issue of Palestine, and all their efforts ended in failure. Al-Houthi pledged that the military would continue upgrading its combat capabilities in naval, air, land, and missile manufacturing domains. Author and journalist Robert Fantina joined us earlier from Ontario to tell us more about Yemeni people's resistance in the face of a war launched by the Saudi-led coalition.
We see, once again, the United States supporting a nation, going into another nation and trying to force a government on the people that they don't want. Even though Saudi Arabia is a very powerful nation, the United States is an extremely powerful nation, the people of Yemen don't want the government that is trying to be forced upon them, and they are continuing to resist, and they will. The United States should have learned from recent history, such as Afghanistan, and earlier history, such as Vietnam, that this doesn't work. Going in, regardless of the amount of bombs and weaponry that you have, will not defeat people who are determined to have their own form of government, to establish it on their own, and they are improving their military equipment, which only goes to show their determination. They are a small country, not very powerful, but they are improving their military hardware, the military base, in order to continue to resist this unwanted interference by Saudi Arabia.
That's a wrap with this hour's World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
These operations have been going on for 15 years straight, so long that mainstream media barely finds the energy to report on it, says Kelly Bokar-Valahas, writer, in an article published under the heading U.S. Bombs Somalia for the Third Time This Summer. Stay tuned for more. We'll be right back. The U.S. conducted another round of airstrikes in Somalia, the third this summer. If you were unaware that the U.S. was bombing Somalia, don't feel bad. This is a completely under-the-radar news story, one that was curiously absent from the headlines in all of the major newspapers recently. Thanks to Dave DeCamp at antiwar.com, however, we know that over a dozen of Al-Shabaab fighters were killed in an August 14th operation by AFRICOM, as described in an official statement recently. He writes, U.S. Africa Command, or AFRICOM, announced the airstrike and claimed it killed 13 Al-Shabaab fighters. The command said the strike was launched against Al-Shabaab members that were attacking Somali government forces in a remote location near Tidan, Somalia. AFRICOM said its initial assessment found that no civilians were injured or killed, but the Pentagon is known for severely undercounting civilian casualties in Somalia. The last U.S. airstrike AFRICOM announced in Somalia took place on August 9th, and before that was July 17th. The escalation comes after Joe Biden ordered up to 500 troops to be sent to the East African nation, reversing a Trump-era drawdown. The AFRICOM statement goes on to say that U.S. forces are authorized to conduct strikes in defense of designated partner forces. There is no clarity on what that means, so we can only guess it is referring to the agreements the U.S. has with the fragile central government there, which is never not under siege by one militant opposition or another. When pressed, the military would no doubt say that it is authorized to strike whenever it wants under 2001 authorization for the use of military force, because Al-Shabaab is considered an Al-Qaeda offshoot. We know that justification is a stretch. Other justifications in the past have included tactical defense of U.S. forces and partners, which was used after questions were raised about a 2016 airstrike. Unfortunately, the mainstream media has given so little energy to sussing out authorization anymore that it's practically a moot point. Al-Shabaab, by the way, was created when the U.S. helped to overthrow the courts union after 9/11, which left a convenient vacuum for a new form of repressive rule to take hold in the embattled country. There was no serious Al-Qaeda presence in Somalia, but the U.S. military and CIA have been able to keep a foothold there, conducting over several hundred declared and alleged U.S. actions involving drones, AC-130 gunships, attack helicopters, naval bombardments, and cruise missile strikes, which between them, according to local communities, have killed scores of civilians since 2007, according to Air Wars. There were 52 airstrikes in 2020 and 9 since Biden took office, according to DeCamp. Bottom line, it's been a long time since the U.S. was not bombing Somalia. This comes after a particularly bloody period during the GWOT, in which the CIA was using the country to detain and torture terror suspects from across North Africa. Whether this has ultimately been a good thing for the country or for the broader security of the region, one need only to look at the continued instability and impoverishment of the people of Somalia, and of course, the persistent presence of Al-Shabaab itself.
IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
In recent months, Lebanon has been negotiating to settle maritime border registration with the Zionist occupation. This negotiation, which has known difficulties and included new and illogical demands from the Israeli entity's side, is apparently nearing its end with a very good possibility that no agreement will be reached in the coming weeks. All the while, Hezbollah continues to up the ante against the Israeli occupation, warning of the possibility of military action, most likely against a naval target, and in particular against the Karish gas rig located offshore occupied Palestine in the eastern Mediterranean Sea. It is possible that in the absence of an agreement in the coming 10 days that would regulate the maritime borders between occupied Palestine and Lebanon, Hezbollah most probably will initiate the fight against the Israeli occupation, but in a new way. The Israeli occupation forces have already thickened their presence around the Karish gas rig. However, Hezbollah is the most serious fundamental threat to Israeli theft, occupation, and aggression in all of West Asia. Its military power is significantly stronger than any other resistance group Israel has faced so far, and even other armies in the region. The Israeli entity's scenario, as per its own media, for a war against Hezbollah includes hundreds of dead soldiers and severe damage to buildings and infrastructure throughout Palestinian areas occupied by Israel. This is because of Hezbollah's ability to launch thousands of rockets in a short period over many days, with great precision and firepower. The Lebanese resistance possesses approximately 50,000 short-range rockets of up to 40 kilometers, not including mortar bombs, in addition to approximately 100,000 medium and long-range rockets, dozens of which are precise and accurate. Israel has calculated that approximately 1,500 rockets will be launched each day of fighting on average from the territory of Lebanon. In addition, Hezbollah is expected to use the Radwan unit, a special ground maneuver force whose mission is to penetrate territory occupied by Israel, liberate Palestinian land from illegal Israeli settlements, and disrupt supply lines or movement of Israeli occupation forces. Hezbollah also owns a fleet of unmanned aerial vehicles and explosive drones. On top of that, Hezbollah is expected to use advanced anti-tank and anti-ship missile launch systems. In words of a Hezbollah field commander who gave an exclusive interview to Lebanese Al-Akhbar daily last week, the task for the military formations of the Islamic resistance is to break Israel in any future battle, as this is considered one of the first steps towards its elimination. In short, as a sitting duck, Israel awaits Hezbollah's winter fire. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. It is set. In the absence of an agreement in the coming weeks that would regulate the maritime borders between Lebanon and the Zionist Israeli entity, Hezbollah will move towards what it already warned the Israeli entity against, a war to preserve Lebanon's rights in its natural resources. Israel is striving not to reach war because, as simply put by a prominent Hezbollah field commander who gave an exclusive interview to the Lebanese Daily Al-Akhbar newspaper, if Israel leads us to war, we will fight it vigorously. The field commander warned that any upcoming war will be devastating for the Zionist entity in every sense of the word, affirming that the destruction of the entity will be greater than it ever imagined. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Mikhail Awad, author, political commentator, and media director of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Awad. Now, at the center of the resistance decision-making process in Lebanon, the trend was clear-cut. As one field commander, a jihadi leader in the resistance, Hezbollah, told Al-Akhbar, he said Hezbollah has entered a new phase and the mission of the resistance has evolved and its features have changed. Can you translate that on the battlefield as the tension rises between Lebanon and Israel as we approach September and the maritime border dispute is yet to be resolved between both sides?
This is the new phase that the resistance and all of the axes have entered. As Sayyid Nasrallah announced when he raised his finger and said, just as the land is ours, so is the water and all what is beneath it. Just as the skies are also ours, after the resistance declared its position of air defense weapons. What the field commander and Hezbollah stated for Al-Akhbar is just a translation of the resistance and its axis completing its preparations and all elements of transition from a defense strategy to an attack strategy. We see this in different battlefields. It is reflected practically in Lebanon. As the Islamic resistance have begun setting dates for confrontations, it has also started setting its options and directions. The upper hand in this matter is clearly for Hezbollah, when it declares that during September the maritime registration should take place as per the demands of the Lebanese government, or else there will be no gas and oil to be extracted, not only at the border with occupied Palestine, but rather throughout the entire eastern part of the Mediterranean. This means that the resistance will be the initiator of this upcoming confrontation and that the resistance's demands will be met without any deficiency. The enemy and its allies have no time for procrastination and maneuvering. If things head towards a military confrontation, then the resistance will be the one to decide 0 hour, the battlefield location and the mechanism to end this confrontation. There is no doubt that there will be a confrontation between Israel and the Islamic resistance Hezbollah in Lebanon. If not because of maritime disputes, then it will be ignited for the many other disputes. In my personal opinion, I believe this war will take place either within weeks or within the upcoming 3 months, tops. At that point, when it happens, it will be dubbed the War of Liberating Palestine from the river to the sea.
Well, that is one dream that every true Arab is looking forward to, Dr. Awad. But another shocking statement that this anonymous field commander of Hezbollah said was that the enemy should know that the war with Hezbollah this time means the destruction of the infrastructure of the Israeli entity, which will turn the settlers' lives into real hell, unquote. What difference does it make if that actually happens when Lebanon also gets hit by the Israeli entity and its already weakened infrastructure is all destroyed? I mean, what good can that bring with such statements, if you will?
The Zionist entity has always attempted to terrorize the Lebanese public by claiming that it possesses a massive destructive power, whether via war jets or via precision missiles, which are capable of causing grave damage. Hence, the threats made by Hezbollah field commander concerning the destruction of the Israeli entity's infrastructure is upping the ante in the face of the constant Zionist threats. This is a strategy aiming at challenging the enemy by openly saying that our destruction equals your destruction too. For instance, during this past weekend, a voice recording was leaked, most probably from within the circles of the resistance, calling the resistance fighters and the civilians alike who reside at bordering villages to occupied Palestine to be careful when they enter the liberated Palestinian villages in the Upper Galilee to protect property, cars and the security in those areas. This all means that he who decides upon 0 hour, which most probably be Hezbollah, will also control the course of the battle. When the battle begins and Hezbollah resistance fighters enter the Upper Galilee, Israel will not be able to maneuver, neither in geography nor in its ability to launch missile attacks, nor make use of its Iron Dome, nor its war jets that might not even find runways to land on when they return after the air raids. So this speech about destruction emphasized the increasing capabilities of the resistance, not only in precision missiles and armed drones, but also that its firepower is similar to that of the Israeli enemy, fully capable of causing major damage and destruction inside enemy lines. Mind you, this speech is very effective at the psychological level, knowing that the Zionist settlers are not the kind that remain steadfast during confrontations. On the contrary, they would rather flee than stay behind and fight for their entity. If this war will take place, it will do so within the heart of the Palestinian land.
Well, but there's one other thing that actually is a challenge for Hezbollah, and that is the internal political foes of the Islamic resistance in Lebanon. In the event of a war between the Lebanese resistance and the Israeli entity, do you think that Hezbollah's back, meaning the internal Lebanese arena, will be actually safe for the resistance, or we will be seeing for the first time several fronts being utilized against the Lebanese resistance with the internal Lebanese land with it? With 1 minute, please.
In the event of a war, I believe that Hezbollah's back will be fully protected from within the Lebanese territory against all rumors. This time, the back of the resistance will be more protected than the last war in 2006. Because in 2006, the resistance faced a huge challenge internally, initiated by the cabinet and its prime minister at that time. We had back then ministers who not only covered for the massacres committed by the entity, but also provided the enemy with intel about resistance locations. This presented a grave danger to the resistance. However, today, whatever happens, even if a war breaks out, we know that the entire Lebanese regime stands behind the Lebanese resistance. Just 2 weeks ago, when the American envoy negotiating the maritime dispute, Amos Hochstein, he met with all three presidencies and they all stood behind the resistance, which means that the actual Lebanese government, unlike what we were used to from former governments, actually stands in a different place in support of the resistance. That was applicable due to Hezbollah's wisdom that kept reminding everyone that the resistance and its weapons stand in service of all of the Lebanese people to retain sovereignty and to help Lebanon out of its current crisis. In short, if one morning we woke up and suddenly saw the flags of Hezbollah and Palestine raised upon the illegal Zionist settlements, it will be a magnificent scene, not only in Lebanon, but all across the Arab and Islamic world.
Well, across the whole world, that is a dream and that we wish will come true and we believe will come true. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Mikhail Awad, author, political commentator, and media director of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance, for joining us. Thank you for your contribution. Please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the escalating targeting of the U.S. occupation bases in Syria.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, since 2016, the U.S. occupation Al-Tanf base has been located at the intersection of the Syrian-Iraqi-Jordanian border, supposedly housing Maghawir al-Thawra faction, as it was the base that was established to fight Daesh. Coincidentally or not, the presence of Daesh is still concentrated in the nearby valleys of that specific base, a presence that is activated from time to time, perhaps to bring an international justification to extend the life of the American occupation of Syrian territory. However, these attacks have intensified and expanded hours after the American assault on Deir ez-Zor last week, putting these attacks at a pace of systematic escalation separate from any possible political development in Vienna. Targeting U.S. occupation in Syria intensifies in this following report.
Washington is deliberately heating up the front against the auxiliary forces of the Syrian army after the bases of the former in Atenf and Al-Umar were repeatedly bombed. However, the response of the Syrian Arab Army forces was also not late, as they targeted American occupation bases again amid expectations that these attacks would only escalate in the future. An escalation that appears aimed at doubling the pressure on the U.S. forces of occupation to push them to leave Syria in light of the Astana trio, Russia, Iran, and Turkey, agreeing on this end goal. Not a few hours had passed after U.S. occupation war jets attacked positions of auxiliary forces of the Syrian Arab Army in the Ayyash area in Deir ez-Zor, until these fighting groups responded by targeting the two bases of the international coalition in the Conoco and Al-Umar oil fields in the eastern countryside of Deir ez-Zor, which hosts American, British, and French occupation soldiers. As a result, there were casualties among the coalition forces. The U.S. military announced that an American soldier was slightly wounded, while two others were being examined for minor injuries following missile attacks in Syria at their occupation bases. On the other hand, the American forces targeted again Syrian Arab Army points in the Hawija Saqr area near Deir ez-Zor and near the city of Al Mayadin and Jabal al-Thurda, all knowingly Syrian Arab Army positions and not, as the U.S. claims to be, Iranian-backed forces. This development prompted the coalition to mobilize its forces and to request the Kurdish separatists' leadership to deploy fighters along the Euphrates River, separating its areas of U.S. control and those under the Syrian Arab Army's control in participation of attacks from the latter against the former. For its part, the U.S. Central Command acknowledged in a statement that its bases had been bombed, pointing out that several missiles fell within the vicinity of the mission support base in Conoco. A short time later, rockets landed near the mission support site in the Green Village, also known as Al-Umar Field. Perhaps what reinforces Washington's fears in this context is that the fighting groups that used to target the vicinity of American occupation bases with mortars and rockets without causing significant material damage to the bases themselves, this time deliberately dropped all the missiles on the two bases' headquarters, with the aim of producing the greatest possible damage in them, and emphasizing that the following targets will directly hit those sites, in order to double the military pressure on the Americans. Perhaps the U.S. announcement of the state of alert reflects the influx of intelligence information about the possibility of a military escalation against the coalition occupation bases in both Syria and Iraq, in light of the Syrian, Russian, Turkish, Iranian consensus on the need for the Americans to leave Syria.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Mr. Tahsin Halabi, political commentator and researcher. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Halabi. And I know that you are suffering from electricity outages and several other technical issues. So I thank you for being with us despite these technical difficulties in Syria because of the sanctions. Now, let's begin at the center of the resistance in Syria against the U.S. occupation and with the escalation of the targeting of the American Atenf base. We see that these attacks not only include Atenf, but also Al-Umar and Conoco field bases as well. And they came in the wake of the American aggression on Deir ez-Zor, targeting Syrian Arab Army forces, which Biden directly ordered himself. But in light of this boiling nuclear file in Vienna, how do you assess this escalation against U.S. occupation bases inside of Syria?
I believe that after years of the presence of U.S. occupation forces at the triangle border between Syria, Iraq and Jordan, which is known as Al-Tanf base, I believe that stressing on the continuation of this occupation as per the Hoover School of Geopolitics is simply to prevent ties between Syria, Iraq, Iran and Jordan too. Closing the borders at that specific triangle aims at hindering military, economic and political ties between the countries of the region. Hence, this is a strategic goal for the United States of America. But can the U.S. challenge three countries by breaching their borders and hindering them from forging ties with one another against their will? I think that is impossible. Simply because the aim of the U.S. is beyond that. It aims at disintegrating Syria and Iraq. For instance, in Iraq, the U.S. is currently working on creating a separatist entity of Sunni Iraqis similar to the separatist Kurds in Syria. In the end, will this plan work? I believe the opposite will happen. All of Iran, Iraq, Syria, and the resistance factions in Syria and Iraq will increase their efforts to spoil the U.S. plans for the region. I personally believe that the U.S. will not remain inside Syria for more than 1 year. That will be possible due to the boiling security situation, not only in West Asia, but also between Russia and Ukraine, and due to the Chinese threat against U.S. hegemony in Taiwan. So there is a global wave against U.S. hegemony, and so regionally it is obvious that the axis of resistance that has the upper hand in the fight against every form of occupation inside Syria and Iraq as well.
Well, Mr. Tahsin, I definitely hear what you're saying, but according to the official U.S. statement that was released after the attack on Deir ez-Zor, it says that seven infrastructure facilities of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard were targeted in Deir ez-Zor in order to, and I quote, protect American bases from additional attacks, unquote. By claiming to target these Iranian so-called groups, the U.S. dodges the biggest question of all. What are they doing occupying Syrian land to begin with? I mean, the international community is obviously on another planet, but how much longer do you think the U.S. can play this game when 80% of the country is liberated and back in the hands of the Syrian Arab army?
I believe that the U.S. is trying to tell both Iraq and Syria that the presence of its soldiers in Syria and the war it is waging on the peoples of these two countries aims to simply remove those so-called militias. While knowing that it is these resistance groups in Syria and Iraq are the ones who initially stood against Daesh and Nusra, who came to be with European and American funding and training, these resistance factions are the ones capable of fighting and winning over the Takfiri terrorists of Daesh and Nusra, and not the US occupation whatsoever. It was evident later on, after the global war on Syria began, that it is in fact the US that is supporting these Takfiri groups instead of fighting these terrorists. This is why the US feels compelled to destroy the factions that belongs to the axis of resistance that chose to challenge the American schemes on West Asia. These resistance factions are defending their countries, their lands, from Takfiri terrorism. The Iranian, Iraqi and Syrian people know very well that it is the axis of resistance that rid them from terrorism and not the Americans whatsoever.
Well, everyone knows that the U.S. occupation does not really stop at anything. It does not stop and think of the consequences of its occupation and its aggression unless its soldiers lose their lives in these occupied territories and their movements become subject to maybe bombardments or sniping or shelling as what resistance would do against an occupation. Will the current attacks, unprecedented in their momentum, by the way, be the first step in a series of retaliations to completely eliminate American presence inside Syria? And most importantly, if it does, will it work? Will they leave Syria?
I think the U.S. is playing a game of gambling at this specific triangle border between Syria, Iraq, and Jordan. The U.S. is gambling without even having the necessary capital to support its game. It has no power to succeed in its adventure that it is currently engaging in. The US occupation bases in Syria are engulfed by Syrian civilians, by the Syrian Arab Army, by the Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi, and by other resistance factions operating in and around areas illegally occupied by US forces. Hence, it is these resistance factions and legitimate regional armies that will engage against US occupation forces and target US occupation bases. Can the US challenge these factions and these armies, especially in the northeastern part of Syria? I find it hard to achieve. Its schemes have failed so far. Then how on earth will it be able to confront the wrath of those factions who own the land and who are ready to sacrifice their lives to defend it? So yes, the US will face ever-increasing escalations and targeting against its soldiers, its armored vehicles and its trucks that it is using to loot Syrian oil and gas. The soldiers of the Syrian Arab Army will not choose to stand aside and watch the US occupation wreak havoc in its homeland. The same goes for Iraq. The Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi have announced time and again that it stands against any form of US occupation inside Iraq. Hence, this challenge will lead to an armed confrontation against the US occupation forces in both Iraq and Syria, and the US will have to pay a heavy price of leaving after being dealt a massive defeat from this region.
Well, it seems that the entire region of West Asia is boiling, and we might see some place or else, not even only in Syria, but maybe also in other places, some sort of ignition and clashes that might lead to a big war in the region, but still have to see in the upcoming weeks. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Tahsin Al-Halabi, political commentator and researcher, for your contribution about talking about the intensified attacks against the U.S. occupation in Syria. And thank you. Please stay tuned, because the upcoming couple of weeks are going to be intense in West Asia, most probably between Israel and Lebanon. So stay tuned next week on the Middle East Stream.
In the limelight.
The Israeli regime launched on August 5th a three-day military attack on Gaza, in which it killed 49 Palestinians, including 17 children and 3 women, and left 360 injured, among them 151 children and 59 women. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Hamza Salha Ryder. This article is published under the heading The Jabalia Massacre: Heaven Embraces Five Angels. On August 6, Noor Diab woke her child, 4-year-old Jamil, to have a late lunch. He asked her to make him noodles. She fed and bathed him. Then Jamil put on his new clothes, his father Najmuddin's cologne, and his hair gel. Shortly thereafter, Jamil went to the market store with his two sisters to buy crisps and a bar of chocolate. His teenage relatives, Muhammad and Hamid, were in the graveyard, so he met them there while his sisters returned home. The Jabalia camp is one of the most densely populated areas in the blockaded strip. Because there are no parks in their neighborhood, the children living there always go to the graveyard to play and have fun. Jamil Muhammad Hamid, Jamil Ihab Najm, 13, and their friend Nazmi Abu Karash, 13, were sitting near their grandfather's grave in front of their houses. That's when the Zionist regime targeted them, although there were not any fighters there, according to eyewitnesses. Noor said, "Suddenly I heard a massive blast. My two other daughters and I escaped to the western room to protect ourselves. Pedestrians started shouting that the bombardment was in the graveyard. Noor's brother-in-law's wife was screaming, 'Jamil has been killed. Jamil has been killed.' I didn't believe her as I hadn't known he was in the graveyard," Noor said later while holding back her tears. "When I learned Jamil was murdered, I fainted. When I woke up, I could not receive any mourners. Because Jamil's body was shattered into pieces like his three relatives' bodies, Noor could not hug him before burying him. The raids which targeted the Jabalia graveyard killed five children. Four of them are cousins, and one is their neighbor. I don't think the Israeli regime will be held accountable since it has never been held accountable before," the grieving mother added. Ismail Abu Mahdi, 36, was standing by the Western Cemetery gate at the moment of the bombardment. Ismail said, "I heard a massive explosion in the graveyard. I was confused about whether to enter or run away until I heard a scream, 'My son, my son.' He directly rushed in and saw children's bodies scattered everywhere and their blood covered three graves, one of them their grandfather's." Ismail said, "Then a father of a martyr carried the remains of his son and entered his house, hoping that his son was alive. Another father carried the remains of his son to the ambulance." The Zionist regime launched on August 5th a three-day military attack on Gaza in which it killed 49 Palestinians, including 17 children and